Take a minute to think about how much time you spend online. If you're like most of us, you check your email or log into social media pretty much first thing in the morning. And we both love and hate that connection, right? And I can catch up with an old friend on Facebook or see what's happening halfway around the world in real time through Twitter. And that's great. But I also worry about what all that time online is doing to my attention span and my real human relationships. So we'll talk about that in a bit. But first, maybe there's something even more important to worry about. In her new book, The People's Platform, filmmaker Astra Taylor argues that our digital life is undemocratic, that we've handed our political and economic power over to giant tech corporations who make money off of our posts and tweets. In other words, there's a reason we just can't get enough of the internet.
I think we need to talk about the way that these devices and these platforms and these websites are actually addictive by design. Every aspect of a website like Facebook is tested to see what gets us to engage the most. So everything from the color schemes to where buttons are placed, and they need to maximize our engagement, to maximize our clicks, because they get data from that. And that's actually the business model of these sites. They're advertising financed. And so they need us to engage and to give more information and to like as many things as possible, because that's where the profit comes from. So I think it's important to shift that, to go, this is not just about us being unable to control our impulses. It's more like the way sugary cereals are stocked on the bottom row at the grocery store so that, you know, kids go crazy and can't help but ask their parents for them.
Well, this sounds like media criticism 101 in the sense that, remember the discussions of subliminal advertising back in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, there is something surprisingly retrograde. I've been saying that we've almost arrived in a retrograde future, because there was this idea that the internet would break us out of all of these old systems and out of the old media model, you know, out of the old broadcasting model where a small number of people got to tell us what to watch because they programmed the television or the radio. But I that's why I find it so interesting that for all of this technological innovation, we're still actually completely advertiser dependent. I mean, with the exception of Wikipedia, we do not spend any time on non-commercial spaces on the web. No, you know, there's no significant non-commercial website online. So we're in this strange moment where you see a resurgence of things like native advertising, which is essentially brand sponsored content or news, you know. This conjures up the old days of soap operas that sold soap, or the Camel News Caravan, which was the cigarette sponsored news show. So again, the retrograde future, we've kind of come forward technologically, but economically, we're still in the old days.
Well, that kind of sheds new light on why everybody likes Mad Men so much.
Yeah, I mean, because it's still relevant. That's still, in many ways, the system that we're in. And, you know, the advertising industry has not been disrupted, to use the kind of Silicon Valley jargon, at all. There's more and more money going into that arena, and more of it's flowing online in ways that I think are pretty troubling if you care about democracy. And that really is media criticism 101. And I think there was this idea that the internet almost made that kind of media criticism irrelevant, because, again, we would all be able to choose and be in charge of ourselves in this digital sphere. And I think what we need to actually think about how that school of thought applies in a digital age.
I guess in some ways, maybe we sort of feel like the ads are just the price we have to pay for getting this huge thing called the internet. I mean, for example, yeah, I liked Facebook a lot better before all the ads, but, you know, mostly I see them as an annoyance and I scroll past and I just don't look at them. And I do get to connect with my friends for free. Maybe the ads are just the price I have to pay.
Right. And I think there needs to be a more critical interrogation of the idea that we get these services for free, because, you know, advertising isn't free. We are paying with our data, which is what these marketers then collect and analyze and use to reach us with their targeted pitches. And I think there are actually social costs that go far beyond just the kind of annoyance element of, you know, sort of these things in the side of my browser that I don't want to look at. And those elements are really important, because the way that advertising used to work, it was much more straightforward, right? Something would come on the TV or the radio that interrupted the regularly scheduled programming and you could turn it off. But what happens is you can never turn off these systems of tracking online. I mean, and this leads not just to, again, the annoying ads, but to things like price discrimination, because what one person sees on the web isn't what another person sees online. So I might get an ad that says, you know, Astra Taylor, enroll at this fancy college next year. But somebody else might get an ad that says, hey, enroll at this predatory for-profit college. You know, there's real concerns about redlining, about people being offered different interest rates or different prices on goods that will kind of reinforce old social inequities. So again, it's not as simple as just seeing ads. There's also this question like, well, what kind of culture do advertisers want to support? Because you might say, okay, it seems like a fair trade-off now. I liked Facebook better before. But the question is, what direction is it heading in? And so we're seeing signs of that with things like the pay to promote. You know, it's getting harder and harder for groups to reach their bases, the people that they've managed to connect with. You know, a community group might have 10,000 likes or something like that, but now it's only reaching a fraction of them when it sends out a message.
And on the other hand, it's interesting that a lot of us regard the internet and digital technology as this great democratizing force, you know, that gives everybody a platform to be heard regardless of status. I mean, think about the Arab Spring or the recent democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong.
That was something that really motivated me to take a more critical look, because I've got various sort of sidelines. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I work as a journalist, but I also do a lot of organizing and activism. And so this issue of democracy really matters to me and people having a voice. And I was concerned about the fact that we are handing over so much power to these corporate platforms, because the internet, again, because there are very few non-commercial spaces online, we confuse ourselves when we talk about it as a sort of public square. You know, when I go out and I protest in the streets, I have certain rights, rights that cannot be impinged upon by the government. I have the right to assembly and free speech and stuff like that. And when you go onto these social media sites, you are agreeing to a terms of service and you're handing away a lot of those rights. So if those are kind of our agoras in the digital age, you know, there are real concerns in terms of maintaining our freedom to protest and our freedom to challenge people in power.
Sure, but can't you do the same thing online? You can create a blog and put it up there, make a video and put it on YouTube.
Yeah, the thing is that you can, but those sites ultimately can take anything you put up there down. And there have been some examples of Middle East protesters putting up pictures of the documented violence onto a site like Flickr, wanting to spread the word and say, this is happening to us. And then Flickr took all of the photos down and said, well, you know, we don't allow pictures of violence on our site. And they were saying, well, these are political photographs documenting something really important. So it's just that sense that these spaces are not safe. We can't count on them in the same way because, again, they're private. I mean, I can't go and lead a protest in a shopping mall, right? Because that's not public space. That's private property. And these platforms are more like private property. They're more like shopping malls than they are like the things we like to compare them to. We like to say Google's a library, or we like to say Twitter's a town square. But there are major differences there. I feel like our analogies kind of confuse us. I feel like the question to me at a philosophical level is like, well, what would a real public square look like in the digital world? Like we don't have any real examples of that. And I think it would be kind of neat to get together and try to make those.
It's really interesting hearing you say that because, you know, these same critiques were made of commercial television back in the dark ages. And it's kind of funny to think it was only, a few decades ago that NPR was created. Are you saying we need a public digital sphere? And then what would that look like?
Right. I think we do need that. It's really interesting to go back to the history books and read about the evolution of public or non-commercial media in the United States. And we were pretty late on the bandwagon, right? Mm-hmm. Something like public broadcasting only emerged in the 60s. But people were sounding the alarm about it and trying to build alternatives going way back to the early days. And so I feel like we could hypothetically be heading towards that kind of tipping point in the digital space where you just go, I'm tired of all my news being actually like branded content.
So you're really talking about maybe we're heading toward a new era of regulation on the internet and simply applying some of the same kinds of regulations the FCC applied to radio and television stations maybe need to be kind of readapted for the digital age. So that's kind of at this larger political level. What about, are there things that individual users could do?
Yeah, there's, you know, we have to not be as susceptible to convenience as the ultimate virtue. And it's very hard as an internet user. I think that if we could resist convenience, the temptation of convenience, and do things that are a bit more difficult in the digital space, that could have a big impact. So what do I mean? I mean things as simple as not always buying everything from Amazon, right? You can buy books from your local bookstore, even if you're not physically near them, by going to that store's website. Since writing my book, I've started to use non-Google email services. There are things like riseup.net, which is a nonprofit privacy respecting email service, or Fastmail, where you pay, you know, a small sum in the scheme of things for email, but in return, you're not paying with your personal data and you're not being subjected to advertising. So I think there are lots of little things that we can do. But in the book, I try to balance these individual options with an awareness that we do need to think about bigger collective political fixes, and that we shouldn't be so afraid of the word regulation. I mean, you know, doing nothing means that we are basically giving more and more power to the marketing, advertising and marketing industry, and to this handful of big corporate players.
Astra Taylor is a filmmaker and author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age.